across the city and South Cambridgeshire.
This is Lee Chambers.
Cambridge 105 Radio.
Coming up to 11:30 now, and I'm joined by my guest, Craig Bennett. Craig, hello.
Good morning, Lee. Nice to see you.
Yeah, nice to have you here. How are you feeling? Because you did the half marathon yesterday, okay?
Good, actually. You know, legs are hurting a little bit. I got a little bit cramp in the last mile, which was a shame. So I had to walk a little bit, which is just what I tried not to do. But, you know, when you suddenly get cramp, you can't really argue with it, can you?
You can't do anything.
But
no.
I did love it. It was they changed the route a bit this year, and it was even more beautiful than previous years. And through King's College, through Jesus College, it's... Reminds you of what a very special city we live in.
It's lovely. It's lovely. And you're here to talk about things environmental. Outgoing Chief Executive of the Friends of the Earth, Chief Executive Designate of the Wildlife Trust. So things environmental very much in your life. Has it always been about the environment for you? Have you always been interested in that area?
Yeah, it has really. And I'm not entirely sure why. I'm not entirely sure why I got the bug. I can't really pinpoint a precise moment. I think really just from pretty young age, I was really concerned about these issues. And then I got really active in my teens. This was back in the 1980s. And there was, through history, you get these kind of so-called green waves. And we're sort of in one at the moment. You know, that much is clear. But there was certainly one in the mid to late 1980s as well. And that's when I got really active and set up a sort of green group at school and did all this kind of stuff. And that's when I remember saying to a careers teacher when I was about, I don't know, 16 or 17, they said, what do you want to be? And I said, an environmental campaigner.
Well, bingo.
And
done.
He thought I was crazy. He didn't even really understand what that was. So he printed off from his BBC B computer the GCSEs and A-levels that would be needed to become a careers teacher. That's all he could do. So I ignored all that and found my own way to become an environmental campaigner. I'm very pleased I did.
And you've seen over the years that you've been involved the whole debate about the climate change so much. Are you optimistic at the moment with where we are? I know we're talking big issues, but in terms of looking forward, how optimistic do you feel?
Well, I know it's a cliche, but I mean, on this, you can talk about it as glass half full or glass half empty. I mean, certainly in terms of the science, what it's telling us about where we are, we're not where we should be. You know, things are much worse now than we thought they would be. Just because really we've been pretty slow to act as humanity. When I was at university in the early 1990s, we were learning all about climate change and the science of it, and it was all pretty clear then that we had to act immediately, and unfortunately we didn't. And we're still not acting immediately, and so actually the science is much more stark now than it's ever been about just how serious the impacts will be and how quickly we've got to turn things around. And actually the job now is tougher than it once was. What I'm optimistic about is just seeing how many more people are getting active on this issue now. Particularly, you look at things like, you know, Greta Thunberg and the school strikes and so on. You see millions of particularly young people engaged in this issue around the world now. And you kind of think, I don't think that's just going to fizzle out. I think, you know, you do have these waves. You have a surge of support for it, then a relapse and so on. But what really excites me is about what happens when that generation enters the workplace, what happens as they're going to universities, what happens next. I don't think they're suddenly going to decide they're not interested in this issue. So that gives me a lot of hope.
And it's on the political agenda now as well. It's in manifestos as well. Yeah. So it's been talked about at that level.
That's right. You know, we are seeing politicians talking about it and offering more than they ever have in the past. That's not a great yardstick because the real yardstick that matters is not what any commitments that business or politicians are making now compared to what they've done in the past. It's the only yardstick that matters, is it enough to deal with the climate emergency? And sadly, none of them really are offering enough at the moment to deal with the real scale of the emergency. But, you know, it's a process. We have to just keep campaigning, keep pushing, and we can do this. I think the problem is it's not a binary issue. There's no point as to when suddenly it's solved or not solved. I mean, actually, of course, if we could, we would choose not to be where we are now. You know, this is not where you'd start from. back in the at least in the 1960s, 1970s, 1980s, and drastically cut greenhouse gas emissions back then. And it's worth bearing in mind that President Lyndon Johnson received a dossier back in the 1960s about climate change and actually how the best thing would be to try and turn the American economy over to be run on solar power and wind power. And of course, vested interests kind of stopped that happening. So if we were to follow the science, we would have followed the science back in the 1960s and 70s. Sadly, too many people have got in the way of that. But perhaps now, finally, we're starting to break through. But there's still an awful lot to do.
And lots of people, I would say it's on political agenda, it's on people's personal agenda, people getting very angry about it.
Yeah.
We've seen that in Cambridge, of course, with the Extinction Rebellion protests. Mm-hmm. Where do you stand on that kind of action?
Yeah, well, I came out a year or so ago really congratulating the Extinction Rebellion on the emergence of that as a movement. I think it was, they absolutely brought a sense of urgency and passion to the debate that was missing, and I think have done a good job of raising the climate emergency up the agenda. I mean, in fact, they, of course, framed the phrase climate emergency that we all use now, and that's very useful. Equally, I've been quite happy to be critical when I think they get their tactics wrong. And I think when you build any movement, you've got to keep doing it in a way that attracts more and more people. You've got to build that movement. And actually, you've got to use tactics and approaches that reach beyond your current base so that it keeps growing. And sometimes they've got that right, and sometimes they haven't got it right. I mean, you know, the whole kind of the cliche, which actually a lot of people in Extinction Rebellion were opposed to, was that climbing on the tube train in Canning Town. And it allowed that to be framed essentially as, you know, white middle class people stopping working class people going to work. Whether that was true or not is another matter, but that's the story that gets told in the press afterwards. And I think that was a real problem. And I think for all of us as campaigners, for all of us as activists, sometimes it's tempting to do what feels right to us, but actually we've got to reach beyond our current base and our current audiences, and the most important thing is to bring in more people that aren't currently involved. So we always have to think very carefully about the tactics we use and make sure that they do that.
And people were very critical of the action in Cambridge because people said actually Cambridge is, as an environmental city goes, it's not that bad.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I heard mixed reports about that. I think sometimes blocking a few roads and so on, if it's done in a light-hearted way, I think people can be all right with that. Personally, when I heard about them digging up the college lawn, didn't feel quite right to me. And it's a lot of this is just gut instinct, what feels right and what feels wrong. And, you know, that would be different for different people. But I have, in all the years I've done a sort of activism and campaigning, actually, I have a kind of yardstick, which is that if you have an idea of a tactic and it makes you laugh, normally that's quite a good one, because actually if we can, activism is about people coming together in a sense of community and achieving something. And if you're going to build a sense of community, people have got to have fun, you've got to have the social element of it. And there's lots of academic studies that are being done now that actually the movements that grow fastest are those that give people a sense of identity and belonging and fun and all those kind of things. That's really important in activism. And so actually the social element of it is important. So I think, you know, my word there is if you're trying to build a strong movement, build that sense of community and people come together. And I think that's where, say, in contrast, Greta Thunberg has been so incredibly successful. She's built a movement there where people are coming together having fun and actually feeling good about themselves. And they go on a protest there and they feel stronger as a result of it. And of course, that's happened with the vast majority of Extinction Rebellion protests as well. But I think those are the lessons to learn there. We've got to keep getting more and more people involved and not turn people off.
And how are we doing as a city? How is Cambridge doing?
Again, you know, you see some things that Cambridge are doing well, but we could be so much better. I mean, it disappoints me really when I would like Cambridge to be a global leader in sustainability, because look at it, we've got some of the world's very best scientists and researchers here in Cambridge. We have a community in Cambridge that is very tuned into these kind of sustainability issues. We're recognised globally in a sort of globally interconnected hub because of the universities and business here and so on. I think we have all the potential to be one of the world's leading small-sized cities that really demonstrates what it's like to live sustainably. And yet we often miss out on that. I mean, it's kind of interesting, isn't it, that when we put in proper Dutch-style bike routes in the city, as we have done on some of our roads now, you kind of, once they're in, you kind of think, can't believe we never had them, you know, a city that has them. And yet, that's still the case of the vast majority of our roads in Cambridge, of course, still don't have them, you know. And on our public transport, I find it amazing that most of our buses are not electric yet and still belch out, you know, pollution. I find it amazing that actually in this city where it would be so easy to get around with walking and cycling, we kind of think our yardstick at the moment is, well, we lots of people here cycle. I think it's about 40% of journeys here made by cycling, which is way higher than any other British city, which is amazing. But it's far lower than most many European cities. So do we compare ourselves to Oxford, which is the next British city where you have higher rates of cycling, which is still way below Cambridge? Or should we compare ourselves to Amsterdam or Copenhagen or Freiburg? You know, there are 300 cities in the world where bus travel is completely free, including 30 in the United States. You know, if you can do that in those cities, why can't we do that in Cambridge? Why can't we make bus travel free here and make those electric buses so that there's no pollution? You know, there's so much more we could be doing. Why can't we do much better on renewable energy in the city? Why can't we have local decentralised grids, smart grids in Cambridge? You know, this is one city where we absolutely could get this right. And the other thing that's handy is it's just a short ride from London, so the politicians can come up with their high-vis jackets and do all the photo ops and then actually spread the word. You know, we could do this here in Cambridge, but we're not doing it yet. And that's even before we talk about bringing nature into the city, because too often we talk about sort of climate energy issues in one thing, but we talk about people's connection to nature as a separate thing. You know, whenever we talk about the housing problem in Cambridge, and there is one, and we need to have more affordable housing in Cambridge, and we've got a heck of a lot of unaffordable housing, but we need affordable housing, you know, people sort of think, oh, maybe we need to build on the green belt around Cambridge, which I think is crazy, because then you'd lose the whole kind of essence of what makes Cambridge, Cambridge. But we should be greening our green belt around Cambridge. A lot of our green belt around Cambridge is just, you know, is agricultural land, and that's handy, but actually let's bring nature back into the city. And for me, there's real tests like the what happens to the Cambridge Airport site once Marshalls moves out. You know, that is a brilliant opportunity there to, yes, build fantastic affordable housing that is incredibly energy efficient, so that it costs very little to heat, that uses very little water, that has brilliant public transport links, and has nature really being restored, the abundance of nature being restored right into the centre of Cambridge there. Are we going to manage to make that happen? I don't know, because I think we've seen some developments in Cambridge over the last few years that have missed the opportunity on that. So we've got all the opportunities there to get it right, and let's hope we do that, but we don't always do it.
And we've got Brexit, of course, which is now happening. How is that going to affect the environmental environment, as it were?
Well, as Friends of the Earth, we did campaign back in 2016 to remain, and that's because if you look at it, around 80% of our environmental legislation and regulations in this country have been developed in an EU context, and that's just a fact. And so it's a real concern that as we leave the EU, politicians might take it as an opportunity to try and lower environmental standards and regulations. And we've got to bear in mind is a lot of the leading Brexiteers that campaigned for Brexit actually have a history of being quite deregulatory in their kind of ideology about these things. So we know that for many of those Brexiteers, Brexit is fundamentally a deregulatory project, and that's a real concern. What we have managed to do, Friends of the Earth and many other environmental organisations working together, is I think we've raised this up the agenda enough that you're getting the politicians pledging now that they're going to maintain and enhance environmental standards as we Brexit. But there's a lot of questions of trust there about whether that will happen, and even whether it's always in their gift, because sadly, trade trumps everything. And I use the word Trump advisedly in that. The fact is, say at the end of this year, if Boris Johnson finds himself trying to get a trade deal with Donald Trump, he might have made all kinds of promises about maintaining environmental standards post-Brexit. But when it comes down to it, what's going to matter most, a trade deal with Donald Trump or maybe keeping some of those environmental standards. I think he's going to want that White House lawn moment of signing something with Donald Trump, and that will matter more than maintaining some of the promises that have been made on the environment. So we're really concerned about this, and there's just so many of those environmental protections have been made in an EU context. They haven't been properly moved across into UK law yet, despite government claiming they have. And it's something we're going to have to watch, not just for the next year, but for decades ahead, to really try and make sure that our environmental standards should be higher rather than weaker.
And the story, of course, everywhere at the moment is coronavirus and things that are, well, there are environmental implications of that, not only from the development of the virus, but how we got to this stage in the first place.
Yeah, I would say, Lee, there's kind of three areas that I think are worth thinking about. In terms of the connection between coronavirus and the environment, which none of which are really getting much attention at the moment. The first is, how did it emerge in the first place? And actually, the science is pretty clear on this now. I mean, there's still, of course, research still being done on this. But it seems pretty clear now that coronavirus emerged crossing from other species, probably pangolins being traded.
They're monkeys, is that right?
No, pangolins are little scaly creatures that are found in Asia, and they are traded as part of traditional Chinese medicine. And it's thought that perhaps them being traded in Wuhan markets is what led to the jumping of species barrier into humans. It's also possibly from bats, but it looks like probably most likely pangolins now. This has, again, been warned about for decades. For decades, scientists have said, look, if we keep encroaching on wildlife habitat, if we keep fragmenting wildlife habitat, and then particularly if we trade in wildlife for whatever reasons, for medicines or meat or whatever, then it's going to make disease, the emergence of new diseases from the wild into humans, much more likely. And of course, this is how HIV/AIDS came about in the late 1970s. It's actually how SARS came about. It's all of these. You know, this is actually where most of them come. They transfer from other species. And if you fragment those habitats and then you trade in wildlife, no big surprise, you know, you get these kind of diseases emerging. So the Chinese has actually responded this month, in they banned the trade in wildlife now to try and stop the diseases happening. Now, this is huge news, actually, because for years that people have been campaigning against, you know, ivory sales or trade in rhino horn or tiger parts and so on. This is a huge news for the Chinese to ban wildlife trade at long last. It's a shame that it took, you know, coronavirus for this to happen. It's happened, and that's very good news. And we need to see much, much tighter bans on wildlife trade around the world, both for the benefits of wildlife and, of course, for human health. The second thing that's worth noting that I think is kind of interesting is that it's just the kind of the reaction. We're often told that to, say, tackle climate change or so on, we can't do that, it'd be too draconian and so on. But there's measures we're putting in place now to protect our health, and quite right so, that, and actually behavioural responses, that if we did them for climate change, everyone would thought it was crazy, be far too draconian. But we're doing it. So, you know, just heard this weekend, what is it, 16 million people in Italy now on lockdown? Imagine if we were saying that we need to do that to solve the climate emergency. Well, it would be the right thing to do. You know, this is threatening our civilization, but we think all that would be too much. Or the other thing that's really struck me is the complete collapse in people going on planes, you know, plane travel. Well, we were all told that, for, you know, business would say it would be find it really hard to replace their flights with video conferencing if we're talking about trying to cut emissions. But actually, it's happened very easily. Suddenly, you wonder whether these foreign trips and you know, all this business travel was so essential after all, if they found it so easy to cancel it and replace it with video conferencing to protect people's health. And quite right so. But, you know, it makes you think, doesn't it, that maybe it's a bit easier for us to do these kind of measures we need to. But I think the real thing that we need to think about is, look, we were warned that this would happen, and we haven't acted properly. There's lots of echoes there for what's happening in terms of the environmental crisis. But the thing that really concerns me for the future is actually to what scientists would call systemic risk, the possibility of many of these kind of things coming together. So say if you have something like a coronavirus in the future where you've got a third of public sector workers off sick, say, and at the same time you have big climate-related extreme weather, like the floods we've seen recently, people not able to deal with it, and other concerns as well. we often, in our media, in our culture, we deal with these issues one at a time because it's much easier to do so. The real risk to our way of life, if you like, is when you get a lot of these kind of crises hitting together and how they interact with one another. And I question sometimes whether our politics and our media is able to deal with the complexity of these issues all coming together. And that's something we've got to get much, much better at.
Oh, thank you, Craig. I mean, it's a lot to cram into a talk, and we could talk for. We haven't even talked about bees either. I wanted to talk to you about bees.
Well, bees give us hope. You just look at that, Lee. As you look at when we launched the bee campaign at Friends of the Earth, we've had hundreds of thousands of people engage in that, and we won the campaign that we set out to do to ban the pesticides and other things as well. It's just one example to finish on, perhaps, that, you know, when we come together and take action, we can make a difference.
And so, is it looking good?
It's looking
front.
Better for bees. I would never say it's looking great. It's looking better with some of those pesticides banned. But again, we've got to keep that ban in place, and we've got to restore habitat for bees.
Thank you, Craig. So when do you actually start at the Wildlife Trust?
I start in April, properly. I'm sort of cross-fading from one job to the other at the moment. There's things to finish off at Friends of the Earth and things to starting up at the Wildlife Trust. But officially, I begin in April. Very excited.
Good luck in your new
Thank you
role.
Very much, Thank Lee.
Thank you. 105